You heard it before, right? Let me tell you again, memory is a phenomenal gift of God. It allows you to smile at the old days. Can you do that a little bit? Smile at the old days, if you're old enough to have old days. Do you remember your first grade teacher? Do you remember the first car you ever owned? How about your first job? First job. You got that worker's permit and started working. I think about a family that was in our first service, the little family, and they're going to use the gift of memory quite a bit in a very good way at the memorial service of Hank Little's mom that's today at 2 o'clock. And there's going to be a lot of love in that memory. And then I think about the story that Tina shared. Would you say that it's good to have a memory when you can remember things like what Concordia did? Wow, memory. Well, I'm going to speak to you today about a memory that you have, but you've never really experienced what the memory has for you. In other words, all your memories are based on what you've experienced. But this memory, you've never experienced. And yet, you retain the memory. This is an installment in our series, God, the Master Gardener. And what we're doing is we're linking all of the gardens that we find in the Bible, and we're letting it tell us our story. It's God's story, but God's story is a story that's caught up with us. And so when we look at these gardens, we're seeing God's vision and His plan and His determination. And it's all being played out in gardens. And what I want you to know is that you have a garden memory. You have a memory, even though you did not experience the garden that God planted and all that it means. Even though you didn't experience it, you have it. You've inherited it from Adam. You've inherited the image of God from Adam. You've inherited his fall and his condition, but you've also inherited what we're going to call a garden memory. Now, you know, I like movies. The reason why I like movies is because they can carry stories for our culture. Now, you know, I think many of you do, that my taste in movies has broadened since the advent of grandchildren in my life. And now I have become more or less an expert in animated movies. And despite all the silliness in animated movies, they still deal with the big issues of life. And a good example of this is the movie Madagascar. I'm going to show you a scene. What am I doing? I'm illustrating that you have a garden memory. And the scene that you're going to see is about penguins in a Manhattan zoo. And like the Great Escape, they're tunneling to get back to where they should be, Antarctica. And they tunnel up and they find Marty the zebra in his pen, and he's a ham. And they introduce him to the garden memory that's inside. It's inside us too. Enjoy the scene.
Just smile and wave, boys. Smile and wave.
Kowalski, progress report.
We're only 500 feet from the main sewer line.
And the bad news?
We've broken our last shovel.
Rags. Rico, you're on litter patrol. We need shovels and find more popsicle sticks. We don't want to risk another cave-in.
And me, Skipper?
I want you to look cute and cuddly, Private. Today we're gonna blow this dump.
Yeah! You don't see that on Animal Planet! Well, show's over, folks! Thanks for coming! I hope you thought it was fresh! I'll be here all week! In fact, I'll be here for my whole life, 365 days a year, including Christmas, Hanukkah, Halloween, Kwanzaa. Please don't forget to never spay or neuter your pets, and tip your cabbie, because it's broke.
You, quadruped, spreken the English?
I spreken.
What continent is this?
Manhattan.
Hoover Dam. We're still in New York. Abort! Dive, dive, dive!
Hey, you in the top! Wait a minute! What are you guys doing?
We're digging to Antarctica.
And Hootica?
Can you keep a secret, my monochromatic friend? Do you ever see any penguins running free around New York City? Of course not. We don't belong here. It's just not natural. This is all some kind of whacked-out conspiracy.
We're going to the wide-open spaces of Antarctica. To the wild.
The wild? You can actually go there? That sounds great. Hey, hold up! Where is this place? Tell me where it is!
You didn't see anything. Right?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. No, sir.
So, the penguins introduce Marty to what's been in him all the time. A garden memory. To get back to the wild. Deep in him. This resonates, and he longs for something that he's never experienced. He's in this, if you will, this kind of bondage, the zoo. But now he says, you can do that? You can get back to where you're supposed to be? I don't think this is much different than you and I. I think that we have a deep connection, a vestige of memory, a longing, a desire. You say, where do you come up with this stuff, Kevin? Analyze it a little bit. When you look at the world as it is, the world around you, do you ever say, it shouldn't be like this? This is not supposed to happen. How do these things happen? This isn't right. You ever say it?
I say it.
Well, where in the world did you get an idea that this isn't right, that this shouldn't happen, that this is not the way it should be?
Oh.
C.S. Lewis, interesting guy, right? He writes this, desires don't exist for things that don't exist. He talks about having the desire called thirst. And you have that desire because there's such a thing as water to quench it. Same with food, same with sex. On he goes. What he's saying is that if you have this thought that this isn't the world that should be, this isn't the way things should be, it is because you have a longing, you have a vestige, you have a memory, and it knows that it's got to be different than this. Now, I put quotes always that tie in, sometimes obliquely, sometimes it doesn't seem at all, but this one really centers in on what we're talking about. Don't read it now, just let me read a couple of lines from this, and you use it later today just to say, yeah. So C.S. Lewis is writing from The Weight of Glory, and he says, in speaking of this desire for our own far-off country, the inconsolable secret in each one of you, the secret we cannot hide, and yet we cannot tell, though we desire to do both. We cannot hide it because our experience is constantly suggesting it. Our experience is constantly telling us this isn't the way it should be. There's got to be a better then. And we desire that because it's real. We have a garden memory of it. Goes on to say these things, the beauty, the memory of our own past, are good images of what we really desire. But they're not the thing itself. They're only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have never yet visited. You and I, we have this garden memory inside of us. Even though we've never experienced it, we have it. Now, I'm going to take you on a really fast-paced journey, starting in the Old Testament. And I want you to see how the master gardener, knowing that this garden memory is in us, leads it and intensifies it and builds it. And then I want you to see the master gardener stepping into our world. And I want you to see how he goes about restoring the garden in one particular place and how that will lead you and me to leave this place and to make a difference in our world tomorrow. I guarantee you that's where we want to go, and I hope to lead you. Okay. We're not in the garden. Things shouldn't be the way that they are when you talk about disease and murder and betrayal and all the sordid things that we find out there. And to be perfectly honest, that we find in here. God, the master gardener, sees this. And he has a vision. And he has a plan. What is it? To redeem and to restore that garden to humanity. And in order to do that, he starts to build that redemption restoration plan by inviting people into it. And as he does this throughout the Old Testament, you start to sense that the garden longing intensifies. He begins by calling a guy named Abram. Abram lives in a far-off country, and the Lord says, go from your country. I'm going to show you a land. I'm going to make you a great nation in that land. I'm going to bless you in order that, you might be a blessing, and that all the families or nations of the world might be blessed through you. Whoa. God is now including Abram. Abram and Sarai and nephew Lot leave Ur of the Chaldees, and they come to the land that the Lord shows them. And they have a family squabble. Moses, being the older, says to his Abram, being the oldest, says to his nephew Lot, look at the land. Choose what part you want to live in, and I'll take the other. And here's what Lot sees. And Lot lifted up his eyes and saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord. He sees a garden. He sees a dwelling place. He sees a place where he can raise his family. He sees a place where he can have a relationship, where he can be free. He's seen something. And it's like the garden of the Lord. And then this saga plays out for many chapters in Genesis. But when it comes down to the end, I want you to understand that Abraham, never owned 1 acre of this land of promise. He had to buy the cave at Machpelah in order to bury his own wife Sarah in. The promise was given. It touched and intensified the longing, but it was never realized. Hebrews recounts that. It says, by faith, Abraham went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac, Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. He was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. He never experienced that longing restored. But by faith, he kept moving forward toward it. Old Testament survey here. Keep going with me. Think about Moses. Abraham's descendants find themselves now in bondage in a foreign land called Egypt. Lord hears their cry of desperation, and he calls another man named Moses. Moses, he meets at this burning bush. Take off your shoes. The land around this bush that's burning and is not consumed is holy ground. He's about ready to hear the call like Abram did. And here's what the Lord says to Moses at the burning bush. I've surely seen the affliction of my people who were in Egypt. And I've heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings. And I've come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land. Have you heard this before? A land flowing with milk and honey. Abram is invited to go to the promised land. Moses, to that same land, but now it's renamed. A land flowing with milk and honey. I don't know what that means to you. It's a phrase that we use sometimes. I think it means a place where things are together. Where it's more like it should be. It's the garden memory. It's there again. Moses covenants, brings the people out. God makes a covenant with them. They head to the land. But Moses, just on the verge of the Jordan, is called by God to come up to a mountain, not in the promised land, not in the land of milk and honey, Mount Nebo. And the Lord showed him all the land. And the Lord said to him, "This is the land of which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I will give it to your offspring. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not go over there." There it is again. It's the longing intensified, but not yet realized. Well, the people of Israel do inhabit the land. And there's a long saga there. And they build in the land and they have a civil war and there's two kingdoms. And one falls in 722, the southern kingdom in 586. But there, God always sends to the people as they kind of walk in the footsteps of Adam and close their ears to the voice of God. God always sends to them prophets. And these prophets remind the people that they have a garden memory. But the prophets also start to sharpen the point of what that means. Isaiah is one of those prophets. And he writes these interesting words to the people. "My beloved," Isaiah is talking about the Lord God. "My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it, cleared it of stones, and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it, hewed out of wine vat in it, and he looked for it to yield grapes. But it didn't. It yielded wild grapes. And now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard, says the Lord. I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed. Briars and thorns shall grow up." Briars and thorns. Remember to Adam, thorns and thistles you will fight against all the days of your life. Here it is again. God's covenant people have done what Adam did. They wouldn't listen to the Lord, nor follow his ways. "I will also command the clouds and that they rain no rain upon it." Explanation. "For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel and the men of Judah. They are his pleasant planting. And he looked for justice. He looked for grapes. But he only found bloodshed, wild grapes. He looked for righteousness, grapes. But behold, an outcry, wild grapes." Isaiah is saying what? This promised land, this land flowing of milk and honey, this dream that God has for you to be partnering with him to restore it, you've turned away like Adam. And so in 586, the southern kingdom fell and Jerusalem was completely destroyed. And the prophet's words became true. It did grow up with thorns and thistles, desolate. But our God is a covenant-making God. And though we break covenant with him, the covenant that he makes with us, he will never go back on. And so, that same prophet Isaiah, knowing that the nation, the promised land, the land flowing with milk and honey will become a desolate wilderness, makes this promise. Listen to me, all of you who want the righteousness, that's the Eden dream, the garden memory to become true. All of you who pursue righteousness, you who seek the Lord, look to the rock from which you were hewn and the quarry from which you were dug.
Who?
Look to Abram, your father, and Sarah who bore you. For he was only one, but when I called him, that I might bless him and multiply him. For the Lord comforts Zion. He comforts all her waste places and makes her wilderness like Eden, her desert like the garden of the Lord. Did you hear it? This is knowing what is happening in the land and that it's going to be receiving that just deserts of disobeying God. It says he makes the wilderness like Eden, her desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness will be found in her, thanksgiving and the voice of song. All these in the Old Testament, Hebrews says, died in their faith. They never received the thing promised. But having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on earth. Our display, we've changed it every week. You notice what's there now? There's a dried up tree. And that dried up tree represents the fact that throughout the Old Testament, God's people had this vestige memory of the way the garden should be, but the reality was quite the opposite. And yet the prophets kept speaking, look through that wilderness, because the Lord is faithful, and you will see through the desolation that God has a promise to redeem and restore his garden among men. One more prophet. It's the one that Jesse read from earlier, that one child objected to in the back. I don't know who it was. This is the prophet Amos. Amos knows that our God is covenantally faithful. And so at the very end, chapter 9 of his prophecy, he writes these words. You need to picture this. Behold, the days are coming. The Lord isn't through yet. When the plowman shall overtake the reaper. Do you get this picture? Here's a vineyard. It's harvest time. Here come the reapers. They have their knives. They're cutting off the grapes. But the vines are so bountiful that it's taking so much time that the plowman says, hey, guys, it's time to plow. And the reapers are saying, what do you want us to do? We're not finished. There's the picture. Behold, the days are coming when the plowman shall overtake the reaper and the treader of grapes him who sows the seeds. The mountains shall what? Drip sweet wine. And the hills shall flow with that sweet wine. And I will restore. It's going to redeem and restore the fortunes of my people. And they'll rebuild the ruined cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards, drink their wine. They shall make gardens and eat their fruit. The Lord is going to plant them on their land, never again to be uprooted out of the land that I gave them. The mountains shall drip sweet wine. How? God, the master gardener, who we learned in the first message, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And the gospel writer John tells us that one who did the actual creation is the second person of the Trinity, the Word. And this Word who created all things, and not one thing that was created without Him. This Word became flesh. God, the master gardener, stepped into His own creation and stepped into our mess. He came to what? Redeem and restore. What's the sign that this is about to happen? He and his mom get invited to a wedding. And they go to the wedding. And they run out of wine. Mary uses her elbow. Do something. Not quite time, Mom. And then he acts. and he makes a Bordeaux and so much of it. And this is taking place in the hills of Galilee. And suddenly the sign that God the Master Gardener is now on the prowl on our planet to redeem and restore, that sign has been given because those mountains are dripping sweet wine. I take my stand with Jesus' own disciples. I take my stand with the Pharisees and the scribes who criticize Jesus. I take my stand with every non-believer today who would say to Jesus, if you can do that, then why don't you just snap your fingers and miraculously make this planet the way it's supposed to be? And we have the garden. And you're living perfectly in it. Could he do it? Yeah, I think. Why didn't he? Because what Jesus wants most in redeeming and restoring the garden is you. And in order to get you, he needs to do something that will take your heart and saturate it and make it flow not with sweet wine, but with his sweet love. And so what Jesus does is he journeys to his own garden. And he enters a place called Gethsemane, a garden of. And he feels the agony of what love requires. And he says, if there's any other cup, give it to me. But there is none. And John in his gospel says that Jesus was crucified in a garden or next to a garden. And there, on a dried up tree, he takes my sin and yours, and he receives the due desolation penalty for it. And it dries him up. And he's parched. And he rasps. And he dies. But on the third day, in a garden, thought to be a gardener, he cancels out the penalty of death because sin has been forgiven. In creation, I know I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. I can argue with you all day long about the supreme difference between a human being and all other kinds of life. I know I'm fearfully and wonderfully made and that God's powerful. But I'm telling you, the Garden of Gethsemane and crucifixion and restoration, the garden tomb, I know I'm loved. I know I'm loved. So what's all this got to do with us? What's all this have to do with a memory that I believe we have of things ought to be different? A memory of Eden, a memory of the Promised Land, a memory of that land flowing with milk and honey, a memory of a vineyard that's just so beautiful and fruitful. What's this all got to do? Should we all think about maybe there's a geographical place called a Promised Land and we ought to emigrate there and live there? It's not what the scriptures are saying. It's not migrating to a geographical place. It's about living out a longing from a soul that has already been restored. I'll say it again. What this has to do with us is to live out a longing of a soul restored, that wants the world to be like it was and like it will be. He restoreth my soul. Who does? The Master Gardener, who started his ministry at Cana in Galilee and ended it on a cross from an empty tomb. He forgives me. He accepts me. He puts hope in me. Suddenly, my soul has become a garden, His garden. He's restoring it. The garden memory has become a garden reality, but when I look at the evening news, I see the difference between Eden and today. But not here. I have a longing for the garden restored that comes out of a soul that is restored. Three examples. Martin Luther King in 1968 went to Memphis. He went to Memphis in order to be in support of the garbage collectors who were getting an unjust wage. And he wanted to support them. On the night before he died, he gave a speech. It was called the Mountaintop Speech. Two paragraphs. First paragraph speaks to preachers. The second paragraph speaks to all of us. Listen. He says, we need all of you. And you know what's beautiful to me is to see all these ministers of the gospel in the crowd. It's a marvelous picture. Who is it that is supposed to articulate the longings and aspirations of the people more than the preacher? Somehow the preacher must have a kind of fire shut up in his bones. And whenever injustice is around, he can tell it. Somehow the preacher must be an Amos and say, when God speaks, who can but prophesy? Again with Amos, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Somehow the preacher must say with Jesus, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me. He's anointed me to deal with the problems of the world as it is. Then he goes on, talks about himself. He says, well, I don't know what will happen now in Memphis. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. And I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to have a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. We'll get there because Jesus, the Master Gardener, has taken our souls, forgiven them and set them on a direction that He's going. But you see, you've got to see it. He saw it. The next day, He went to the promised land. He's saying, once you've seen it, once you've experienced it, you've got to act. You've got to move. Second example, why is Rick Warren's book, After the Bible, the most sold book in America? What was it called? The Purpose-Driven Life. And I'll tell you why. Because apart from Jesus, everybody's trying to figure out, why am I here? What am I doing here? What am I supposed to do? And some noble things come out of that pursuit. Amen. But when you see the garden restored, have the garden memory and know that it's going to come true and that you are here to close that gap. Then you see your purpose. Then you really come to life. Then you'd lose all to follow this Jesus. Third example, Viktor Frankl. He wrote a book, Man's Search for Meaning. Man's Search for Meaning. Title of his book, Viktor Frankl went through the concentration camp of Nazi Germany and survived. And he writes, and this book is it, Man's Search for Meaning. And what he found in the concentration camp, those individuals who could understand the meaning of their lives in the midst of the misery and right on the cusp of death every day, those who could understand that they had a purpose in this place, he said they were the ones who were able to get up and to live another day. Martin Luther King, Rick Warren, Viktor Frankl, they're all saying the same thing. They've been to the mountaintop. They know that there is a world that's supposed to be, and now that they see Jesus, on they go. Martin Luther and Martin Luther King talked about living with a dangerous unselfishness. You're doing that. I see it among us. I see the dangerous unselfishness. I see parents doing their best in this wild culture to raise their kids to know Jesus. I see children who are adults caring for their parents with a dangerous unselfishness. I see people just blessing their neighbor, be it coworker, neighbor, family member. Well, one of the things that every marriage needs is a dangerous unselfishness. It comes out like this: kindness, respect. There's a gap. The world is as it should be, the world we see on the nightly news. There's a gap. We're sent to move the needle a little bit, to close the gap. I see you doing it. People who volunteer at Beacon of Hope, so moms with an unexpected pregnancy will bring that little one to term and life. People who go to Guatemala with Solomon's Porch and meet some of the poorest people on this planet and help them. People who go to Habitat right here to provide that sense that comes with owning a home. Those of you who give monthly food to North Fulton Community Charities or volunteer there. Those of you involved in prison ministry. Those who are involved with Pastor Joe in meeting the homeless and ministering to them. Those of you who, unbeknownst to anybody else, tutor other kids. Those of you who have Tina's story in a reflection of your own story. The Christian life is to move the needle a little bit. I close with a song from Johnny Cash. I ask that you just reflect on what we're talking about and your own life. Johnny Cash, at the end of his life, had a project, and it was to gather all of the hymns that his mother used to sing, and he called it Hymns from My Mother's Hymn Book. And one of those is about going to the Promised Land. And please think about this. As you listen to the lyrics and hear his wonderful voice, you either can be marching to the Promised Land with that restored soul, or you can just be wandering around in the wilderness until you die. Here's the song.
Yeah. On Jordan's stormy banks I stand and cast a wishful eye to Canaan's fair and happy land, where my possessions lie. I am bound for the Promised Land. I'm bound for the Promised Land. Oh, who will come and go with me? I am bound for the Promised Land. O'er all those wide extended plains shines one eternal day. There God the sun forever reigns and scatters night away. I am bound for the Promised Land. I'm bound for the Promised Land. Oh, who will come and go with me? I am bound for the Promised Land. When shall I reach that happy place and be forever blessed? When shall I see my Father's face and in His bosom rest? I am bound for the promised land. I'm bound for the promised land. Oh, who will come and go with me? I am bound for the promised land.
Well, won't you come and join with us? We're bound for the promised land. Please rise for prayer.